Trump's message to the UN, it's still America first. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump renews his vow to put America first in a speech to the United Nations General Assembly.
America is governed by Americans. We reject the ideology of globalism, and we embrace the doctrine of patriotism.
Trump also had some harsh words for Iran today that will make it harder to see a diplomatic way forward for the U.S. and the Islamic Republic.
As Rouhani said last night, you don't put the barrel of a gun to someone's head and then tell them to sit down. The threat has to be removed before we'll talk.
Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is good to have you here. The UN General Assembly, it's an austere, formal atmosphere, and with only a few exceptions over the years, it's been about respect for the world leaders who speak from the podium.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
And that was President Trump today. The laughter seemed unprecedented. No big surprises in his speech, though, and at times it felt like the U.S. versus the rest of the world.
We will never surrender America's sovereignty to an unelected, unaccountable global bureaucracy. America is governed by Americans. We reject the ideology of globalism, and we embrace the doctrine of patriotism. Around the world, responsible nations must defend against threats to sovereignty, not just from global governments, but also from other new forms of coercion and domination.
Trump's harshest comments were aimed at Iran. He called the government there a corrupt dictatorship that exports mayhem across the Middle East and beyond. In a moment, we'll look at what's going on behind the scenes with U.S. policy on Iran. But let's go back in history to a previous chapter of perceived enemies.
I think you should take Khrushchev, Castro, Tito, and all of them coming over here and sink them out there before they even come in here. They shouldn't be allowed.
That was recorded ahead of the UN General Assembly meeting in 1960. Our BBC partners canvassed New Yorkers on the street, asking them about the invitation extended to Fidel Castro of Cuba and Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier. They were scheduled to speak at UN headquarters in New York City, and reaction from the public was overwhelmingly against the idea. Remember, this was during the Red Scare, and even moderate views were overtaken by the political polarization of the time.
Khrushchev is just a plain ordinary butchers. They are no good. They are just bums, period.
I really don't want him to come here. I think he should just stay where he belongs.
And I feel the same way. He's no good. I don't like him.
I don't either, really.
It seems to me that some of the attitudes that have been adopted towards the communist leaders have been rather childish, one of them being this effort of President Eisenhower to jump the gun and get in front of Khrushchev. I don't think it's a very, very diplomatic thing to have done. He might have done better to have waited to hear what Khrushchev had to say and then answer him. They should all get together, and maybe when you've got them all together, put them in one pen and let them scrap it out between themselves.
We had them all together. Where did we get? Where did we get when we had them all together?
Put them in a cage.
What cage? And shoot them or what?
I don't care. Oh,
well, why make a statement like that then?
Well, you make
well,
a
statement. Well, we had a summit meeting over there.
You didn't have a summit meeting.
We were supposed to have a summit meeting.
But you didn't get one.
And why?
Well, why?
Yeah, you answer that. I'm asking you.
I don't know.
You make that statement. I'll make that statement. You answer it.
I don't know. I wasn't in on it.
Oh, you weren't in on it, but you made a statement here just now, did you?
Yes, I did.
And what was your reason for making that statement?
Because I think it was unwise of President Eisenhower to get in ahead of Khrushchev just for the sake of getting
ahead. Oh, that's your opinion.
Wow. American democracy there in 1960 with New York accents. Now it's 2018 and Iran is the talking point. Joe Cirincione closely follows U.S. policy on Iran. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund. So you met with President Hassan Rouhani last night in New York with a small group of academics, journalists, and former officials. What was that like? I mean, the president of Iran right now in New York City.
Well, I expected some angry rhetoric. It comes just 6 months after President Trump violated the Iran anti-nuclear deal, pulling the United States out of that deal. So I expected the president of Iran to be angry and bitter and vindictive, but he was not. He was calm. He was sober and fairly insightful. I asked him directly whether he thought the deal could survive. And he answered directly, yes, it could. Iran was going to stay in the deal for as long as the Europeans and Russia and China, the other partners in this agreement, keep their end of the accord. And as he pointed out, we've had 12 International Atomic Energy Agency inspections now, and they all certify that Iran is, in fact, complying with the deal. The U.S. is the problem here.
Well, then today we have President Trump at the UN General Assembly. Let's hear from him.
We cannot allow the world's leading sponsor of terrorism to possess the planet's most dangerous weapons. We cannot allow a regime that chants death to America and that threatens Israel with annihilation to possess the means to deliver a nuclear warhead to any city on Earth.
I mean, we've heard that before, but when a Trump puts it like that, it is kind of hard to argue with.
Except for the fact that we've just reached an agreement that stopped Iran from possessing those weapons, that opened the pathway to resolving these other issues we have. Look, we have real differences with Iran. This is not a pleasant regime. Nobody in America would like to live in Iran under this theocratic dictatorship. But in many ways, it's not very different from the other governments in the region. I mean, Saudi Arabia is waging a brutal war that's killed a couple of hundred thousand Yemeni civilians. Iran hasn't done that. You'd have to say that the differences we have with Iran can't be addressed in the way that Trump is trying to address them, that you need diplomacy to fix these things. You want to put limits on the ballistic missiles? Well, you have to get Iran to agree to that. There's no set of sanctions or coercive force that's going to stop Iran from doing that. And that's why some people, when you play this out, think that what Trump is doing is actually laying the groundwork for military action in Iran.
Well, I mean, the way Trump has been demonizing Iran does remind a lot of people the run-up to the war with Saddam Hussein in Iraq in 2002 and then 2003. Yeah. Is war being discussed as an option in the White House?
There isn't any statement from the White House that says that. But what you have is statements from National Security Advisor John Bolton before he entered the White House. He wrote an op-ed, the way to stop Iran from getting a bomb is to bomb Iran. He's a known advocate for this. So is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. So you fear that this is where they're going, that they're replaying the Iraq war playbook, cherry-picking intelligence, exaggerating the threat, demonizing the country, pretending to offer a diplomatic way out when what they want to do is find an excuse for war. And even if that's not the case, even if they don't actually – maybe Trump just wants to threaten war, act tough, but not actually go to war. What this does is increase the tensions in the region so that some incident could trigger – a military conflict. It may be that Trump is trying to replay the North Korea game that he ran, where he – remember a year ago, it was North Korea that was the focus of his ire.
Right.
And he believes that that might force a country or convince a country to then come to the table. And he thinks that worked with North Korea. It may be that he wants to do this. We know that the U.S. wants to have a meeting with Iran, contrary to what the president said. It's the U.S. that has been reaching out to Iran to try to arrange negotiations, and Iran won't do it. As Rouhani said last night, you don't put the barrel of a gun to someone's head and then tell them to sit down. The threat has to be removed before we'll talk.
How worried are you about the prospect of war with Iran?
I'm very worried. I think that intentionally or unintentionally, Donald Trump has put us on a path to war. He's escalating the threats. He's escalating the rhetoric. He's escalating the actions the U.S. is taking. He's now said that or at least his national security advisor has said, that one of the main missions of the U.S. forces in Syria is to counter Iran. So that's now putting U.S. combat troops in direct opposition to Iranian forces. This could get out of control. This could prove a temptation for the president, beset with domestic difficulties, to wag the dog, to come up with an international crisis that he thinks could rally the public around him. And Iran is no peaceful actor here either. There are forces in the Revolutionary Guard who want to take on the U.S., who think the U.S. is isolated in the world now, and now's their chance to push back. So all the arrows are pointing in the wrong direction. We should all be worried.
Joseph Rincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marcos. Always a pleasure.
And full disclosure here, the Plowshares Fund helps support nuclear security coverage here on the world. One more thing about Trump at the UN today. Last year at the General Assembly, the president called Kim Jong-un of North Korea Rocket Man. This year, Trump called him Chairman Kim and thanked him for his courage. And now they're talking about another face-to-face meeting. Kim himself brought it up last week in Pyongyang when he was hosting South Korea's president, Moon Jae-in. And this interesting detail, the two leaders bonded over a North Korean noodle dish called naengmyeon. But you don't have to go to North Korea to try it because, given the paperwork, that could be really, really hard. But Jason Strother went to a restaurant in Palisades Park, New Jersey, where about half the population is Korean.
Naengmyeon is a dish that's best served cold. It literally means ice noodles. My ticket number is called, and I go to the counter to pick up my bowl, which, in addition to the sweet potato starch noodles, contains diced pear, a hard-boiled egg, and two small cuts of grilled pork. I add vinegar and spicy mustard to the soup and use kitchen scissors to cut the noodles. Naengmyeon is a popular dish in South Korea, even though that's not where it originates.
Okay, naengmyeon is two kinds, both of from North Korea.
Cho Yi-soon runs Chega Naengmyeon. He's 69, originally from Seoul, and has lived in the U.S. for nearly 20 years. He explains that during the Korean War, refugees from the north fled south and brought their naengmyeon recipes with them. The two varieties take their names from their home cities.
One is Hamhung Naengmyeon, the other one is Pyongyang.
Pyongyang Naengmyeon is the kind that Kim Jong-un took with him to his first summit with President Moon Jae-in in April, and the two dined on them again last week in Pyongyang. This culinary diplomacy sparked a naengmyeon craze in South Korea this year, and Cho says the free advertising helped his business too.
A lot of customers come over here, oh, Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un ate naengmyeon.
You should thank Kim Jong-un.
Oh, yeah. Probably.
Cho says he thinks naengmyeon is doing its part to help build peace on the Korean Peninsula. He says he supports engaging the North, but there's still a ways to go. Switching to Korean, Cho tells me he's hopeful about peace, but Kim Jong-un still needs to take steps to denuclearize. Cho thinks he has no other option.
Trump is very strong. Attacked. I think he will do.
You think Trump would attack?
Yeah.
Kim Jong-un is not expected to attend this year's UN General Assembly in New York. No North Korean leader ever has. But Cho says he wouldn't be surprised if Kim does eventually come to the U.S. to meet Trump again. And if he ends up bringing naengmyeon with him, he hopes that the president, who once said that he'd like to have a burger with Kim, can at least pretend that he likes these cold noodles. For The World, Jason Strother, Palisades Park, New Jersey.
Coming up on the show, get your dance moves together. Bollywood is hiring more and more Western actors. Our audition is next on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. When it comes to the film industry, Bollywood is the biggest on the planet by far. It cranks out three times as many movies as Hollywood does every year. And with all those films competing for attention, directors and producers in India are under a lot of pressure to surprise their audiences. One recent trend, casting a growing number of Western actors and dancers in Bollywood films. My BBC colleague Vishala Sripatma spoke with several women in the industry to learn more.
Close your eyes and picture a Bollywood movie. Bright colours, lots of music, and lots of dancing. The songs are pretty catchy, and the actors are worshipped. And certainly male actors sustain lead roles well into their 60s and even 70s. Whilst most of those actors are Indian, a growing number of Western, mostly female actors and dancers are landing roles in Indian films. The most well-known is Liverpool-born Amy Jackson. She was cast in her first Hindi-speaking Indian movie with no prior acting or dancing experience. She couldn't even speak the language. Here she is speaking to the BBC about how she landed her first role.
I thought it was mad. The whole family thought it was mad. I remember exactly what happened. I was 16 at the time. It was a week before Christmas and we got a phone call. My dad answered the phone. It was from my modelling agency at the time. I did bits of modelling in between my school. And basically they said, there's an Indian director. He wants to meet Amy. He saw an image of her and she really fits the bill for his film. Dad ran up the stairs and I said, Dad, calm down. I said, let's just listen to what he has to say. He said, but it's a movie offer. I said, we don't know what's going to happen. So he was more excited than me. So a few days later, we travelled down to London and then we met and within a couple of hours, he offered me the film and off I was in Chennai 2 weeks later. The bill fit. It was an English girl I was playing in the first film. So for that, it just happened organically. But then the next roles and the next films that I got offered were obviously Anglo-Indians or also roles of traditional Indian girls also. But I think that foothold into the industry and the acceptance of the audience is what has given me a long-lasting career in India. I got more offers and if I wanted to improve and really, you know, reach the best I could be, I had to learn the language. I had to practice my dancing every day, my Kathak dancing. I get recognised a lot, especially obviously over in India. And with each movie that releases, the popularity grows, the fan base grows. So I've picked my movies very carefully. And so now obviously in the UK, the Indian fan base are recognising me. So it's crazy because I'm just a girl from Liverpool and now I've been thrown into the stardom, I suppose, in India.
Amy is now a household name in India, and she seems to have whet the appetite for more Europeans in Indian cinema. Eka Bose is a dancer based in London who runs a casting agency.
I think it's like an aspirational effect, and I think it's something that kind of shows, oh, look who's doing Bollywood, you know, it like legitimizes the whole kind of... I mean, I don't believe this, but I think maybe that's what the casting directors are going for. It kind of gives that legitimacy to the movie and the fact that, you know, everyone's involved, giving it more of a global appeal.
How do Indian dancers feel about that?
I mean, not great. Obviously, they're representing something in an industry that's come from their heritage. And I mean, for me, it's a complete, like, you know, I'm Sri Lankan and I run a Bollywood dance company. So for me, it's kind of, you know, I'm neutral. I'm whatever the casting director wants is what I present. But I do think, you know, like with any industry, there is an unfairness. But in the same way, I think casting is an example of one thing that kind of gets away with it because you're allowed to cast for what you're looking for.
Where do you see it going then? So do you think this is something that's going to grow and grow and grow where we see a point where actually all dancers in Bollywood movies are going to be white?
I don't think that will ever happen. I hope not anyway. And I think there's room and there's a place for all types of movies and all types of casting. I would hate to see that happen. That would kind of make my job very sad.
Not everybody working in the Indian film industry agrees that there is a higher premium on being a fairer-skinned European. Anisa Bhatt is a British-born actress in Mumbai.
So it's always going to be roles, you know, for the typical foreigner kind of look. But what happens is it just sort of depends on, you know, how you want to be placed, because I've done those kind of roles where I am, it's very evident that I'm supposed to be playing someone who's not from India, but the justification is sort of given that I'm half Indian, half something else. Even when I did something quite recently, the last big commercial film I was involved with was called Half Girlfriend, and my portion was set in the States, so I did have a slight American accent, but it was shown that I was sort of, you know, I was clearly like mixed race, or, you know, half Indian, half something else. But I would just say that if that those are the kind of roles that you want to keep doing, then yes, there is a lot of opportunity here for those kind of things. But I think if you want to grow as an actor and you're not from here and you clearly look evidently different, I think it's tricky. And I think it's difficult, actually, to get the kind of roles and the work that you want.
Is there an advantage, though, of looking Indian? Because you do have some examples in India of actresses that are European that look Indian, because looking Indian is very diverse, given it's such a big country. We can't get away from the fact that fair skin is very much championed by the industry.
So when I initially came, fair skin was a big thing. I remember seeing a lot of commercials which were, you know, particularly endorsing a lot of whitening products. I feel like that has decreased over the time that I've been here, and there is now a greater acceptance for Indian skin, which is great, because I think that's important. Yes, fair skin is championed in a certain way, but I honestly don't think that it gives anyone entitlement to certain roles. In fact, I think looking Indian is favoured, because if you think naturally, if you were a writer writing stories for India with Indian characters, essentially you need those characters to be of a certain look, and you need the casting to be justified. I feel like things are really changing, but I think it honestly depends what you want to do. If you're happy with what's being offered for the way that you look, I think it is great, and there are opportunities. But I think for me as an individual, I've reached a point where I'm more like I kind of know that I'm done with that stuff, and now I'm looking for roles of definitely more substance.
So do you think in India the way you look as a woman is more important, say, in comparison to other markets?
Yes. Yes.
In what way? Is it beauty? You have to be outstandingly beautiful? Is that what the requirement is?
Well, I feel like things have changed, but definitely it's always a requirement. There's always, when castings are being done, you know, your brief is not as detailed as something that you would get on Spotlight in the UK. It's more, you might just get two lines which says, like, you know, 18, 19 year old, fair, beautiful. It might just be that. I'm too sexy for you.
You were hearing there from Anisa Bhatt, a British-born actress living in Mumbai, ending that report from the BBC's Vishala Sripatma. We also heard earlier from London-based casting agent Nilika Bose and the Liverpool-born Bollywood actress Amy Jackson. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead on the show, a Canadian radio host hears from her listeners about Me Too.
Women who called in, and a few men, who called in and talked about serious abuse decades ago. And they really have not been able to talk about it to their families, to their partners, to anyone until now.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The day has come, the time has come. Those were the words today by Judge Stephen O'Neill in a courtroom in Pennsylvania. Judge O'Neill sentenced Bill Cosby to 3 to 10 years in state prison. Cosby was convicted of drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constand. This is another key moment in the story of the Me Too movement. The hashtag campaign began almost a year ago, and it's not over. A string of high-profile men accused of sexual misconduct have lost their jobs, and now some of them are looking for redemption, including former public radio host John Hockenberry. He wrote a 7,000-word essay in Harper's Magazine about what he calls his exile that drew a lot of criticism. Anna Maria Tremonti is the host of The Current, a radio show on the CBC in Canada. Last week, she interviewed Rick MacArthur. He's the publisher of Harper's, about his decision to publish that essay. Here's one moment from that conversation.
He's not been accused of anything criminal, Hockenberry. He's been erased, and that's the argument he's making in his piece. he's been erased from the culture.
Right. Okay. So let me just
He can't work anymore.
Right. So let me just get, hold on. And there is
something in the tone of voice I hear, in your tone of voice and in the tone of voice of the other person who was on the show. It rises to the level of Soviet style re-education.
Soviet style re-education. I asked host Anna Maria Tremonti what that was about.
In the early 90s, I was in and out of Moscow and other parts of the Soviet republics and former republics. So when he used that shorthand for Soviet interrogation, that just struck me as a provocative thing to say. So I shot back. The last time I checked, Soviet interrogators were not on a mission to question those who try to uphold the status quo.
Right.
And arguably, that's what Mr. MacArthur was trying to do.
I got to say, I listened to your interview with MacArthur, and what struck me most was how he was interrupting you. I mean, really kind of running away with the mic, and I couldn't help wondering— I mean, you host this show every day. How common is that experience?
It happens occasionally. And in fact, I have a clock in front of me and I'm watching the time go because it was live to the Atlantic Canada and then we roll over in time zones. So I knew I had a finite amount of time with him and I wanted to get to a different discussion. I wanted to ask about, first of all, I wanted to know why he thought it was that this was an essay that he needed to publish in his magazine. And then I wanted his views on what that's all about, on the so-called redemption or the reentry of people who have been forced out socially and then ostracized like Hockenberry had been. And, there is a conversation around that and I wanted to hear his view, but we never got there.
That interview was last week. And yesterday, you dedicated your show, The Current, to the Me Too movement. You went live for 5 hours asking Canadians what they thought of the Me Too movement.
Allison is on the line from Montreal. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
What are you thinking? Where do you think the Me Too conversation should go next?
I came out around just before, actually, the Me Too movement blew up with my story. And no one sort of talked about the aftermath of that. So I was really happy that the show was like you're following up because.
So Anna Maria, let's talk about what you've been hearing. What did Canadians tell you?
Well, some people, overwhelmingly, people said it needs to keep going, that it is not a time to say, well, it's done its thing, right? There's more to do. What really struck me was the number of women who called in and a few men who called in and talked about serious abuse decades ago. And they really have not been able to talk about it to their families, to their partners, to anyone until now. And they credited Me Too. That conversation opened up a conversation for them. So we heard a lot of that. We also heard some fears. One woman calling in to say she has a son and she doesn't know how he maneuvers or navigates through this world because she thinks he's going to be vulnerable to things he's not guilty of. So we heard that fear as well, which is why we wanted to have this conversation.
Was there anything like a consensus on the redemption question?
No. There were a number of people who said, why are we talking about redemption so quickly?
What can we learn, do you think, from having this conversation about sexual harassment and sexual assault on the air?
Well, it's interesting to me because there is this fear and feeling that everything is conflated. And I sometimes in listening to it, I think it's conflated on the other side, that rather than those people who conflate a sidelong glance with sexual harassment or sexual assault, it's the other way around. Some people don't see the severity of sexual assault or sexual harassment, and they think it's no different than some of that other stuff. And so we need to keep that dialogue going. I mean, this is not an easy thing. This is a messy conversation. And I think it's really important that programs like mine actually try to explore some of these things and try to move forward and try to hear what's really going on out there.
Given the platform MacArthur gave to Hockenberry, that the New York Review of Books gave to Gian Gomeshi, formerly with the CBC, what the Comedy Club gave to Louis C.K. in terms of platform, you'd probably agree that there are a lot of men who have some, if not re-education, some unlearning and relearning to do, yes?
Well, what I will tell you is that what I heard in Mr. MacArthur was a disconnect, that he did not understand that the first thing he did was to say, well, he's in a wheelchair. So ergo, what, he can't sexually harass the people he works with? There was a disconnect there. There was a not an understanding of what this discussion is about and the vulnerability of people who are actually making their voices heard that leads to the removal of people who have that power over them. And I think that's the most crucial point, that disconnect. And you have what is essentially a boss at a big magazine with a big reputation. And in the way he answered, I think that you saw the disconnect. I didn't really have to say anything.
There's a question that you put to your guest just prior to Rick MacArthur, Ruth Spencer of The Cut. And it's an intriguing one. I know a lot of people, men and women, are wrestling with it. Are these men permanently unemployable? So after speaking with a wide range of people, after hearing from Canadians all over the country on your show, people thought about this. Where do you land on that question?
I don't land on that question. It's not for me to judge, but it is for me to ask, because I think that is a question. I think that is something we have to look at. And, you know, as somebody who's covered a lot of different stories over many, many years, we ask these questions for people who are found guilty of criminal offenses, who spend years in jail. How do you deal with people who have been found guilty of a crime, or people who have done something that is, again, an offense under a labor code or something else? Are people permanently unemployable, or how do we move forward with this? And that's what I'm trying to understand. I want to hear how other people think about this.
Really intriguing questions. Anna Maria Tremonti, the host of The Current, a radio show on the CBC in Canada. Anna Maria, really good to hear you on The World. Thank you.
Thank you.
And a quick note before we go to our next item. We were talking there about the program, The Takeaway. John Hockenberry was the host. That show is co-produced by PRI, the same organization that co-produces The World. So how are we going to deal with the opioid crisis? Last year, more than 49,000 people died from overdoses in this country, a record number, a tragic number. Different states are experimenting with ways to bring that number down. Some have slapped restrictions on the amount of narcotic pain medication doctors can prescribe. Another thing public health officials are trying is the ancient practice of acupuncture. Acupuncture is not generally recognized as a legitimate form of medical treatment here in the U.S., but in Hong Kong and other parts of Asia, it's a well-established option for all kinds of things. From our partners at The Pulse at WHYY, Alan Yu reports.
In the heart of the crowded streets of downtown Hong Kong, I find a nondescript office building where I take the elevator to the 17th floor. That's the location of a Chinese medicine clinic owned by one of the city's public hospitals. The waiting room looks like any other doctor's office, except for someone behind the counter packing herbs for patients. I meet 28-year-old Gordon Liu here. He's come to treat his shoulder and neck pain. We go inside a large cubicle, curtained off for privacy, and he gets ready. Then his acupuncturist comes in.
Okay.
She puts all the needles in points near his shoulders and neck and hands. After about 20 minutes, she takes the needles out and drops them into a metal bowl. Liu says before this session, his neck was very stiff. But now he is in less pain and feels better. Before he discovered acupuncture, Liu tried Western medicine, including injection painkillers. But he finds acupuncture to be the most effective. For many people in Hong Kong and throughout Asia, acupuncture is that solution. Doctors and hospitals use it as a way to treat pain. But despite being extremely widespread here, this ancient practice is still not well understood. And that may be why acupuncture is not considered a standard treatment for pain in the US, but that's beginning to change.
This one is at your ankle. Do you feel it?
My left ankle, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that.
Okay.
At the VA Medical Center in Philadelphia, an acupuncturist is placing needles in Reno Reale's back. Reale was stationed in Iraq for 3 years and was badly injured in a mortar attack. The Veterans Administration here has been offering acupuncture since the early 1990s.
When I got back from Iraq and they did all the MRIs, it was a lot. I had my sciatic nerve was gone, I had herniated disc, I had disc degenerative disease, I had a lot of issues with my spine.
After he was injured, Reale, who's 38, went through several surgeries. But then he endured major pain and became disabled.
I ended up in a wheelchair because one of the surgeries didn't go well and left me unable to walk and my back really swollen. And I was in so much pain, like just getting out of bed, like took a lot of effort.
For years, doctors prescribed Reality strong opiate narcotics to manage his pain. But he says the medications made him foggy and they didn't really work. So a few months ago, he decided to try acupuncture. And now for the first time since he was injured, he's leading a more normal life and is getting his bachelor's degree.
Being able to be able to sit in a classroom without pain is great, to be able to walk without pain. Like, I was not able to do that with the medications.
Acupuncture is one of the things that should be tried first. And when patients do try it, they are very grateful.
For most of her week, Ileana Robinson is a gynecologist, but she comes to the VA regularly to treat veterans using acupuncture.
Sometimes it's like the first time that they've had a pain level less than 5, for example. Definitely it's something that we hope to be able to offer to more patients as the demand grows.
The VA is a major prescriber of opioids. But with the recent increase in opioid overdose deaths, the agency has been making a push to offer more complementary and integrative health services like acupuncture. And now, the VA no longer requires that acupuncturists also have a medical degree to practice there. More U.S. insurers are covering acupuncture, but it is still not widely accepted in healthcare circles. One problem is that there is little science to explain how acupuncture works and whether it works.
What has been happening is this slow, steady infiltration of pseudoscience like acupuncture into medicine.
Stephen Novella is senior editor of the blog Science-Based Medicine and an assistant professor of neurology at Yale University. He and other skeptics say there's no proof that the ancient practice is much more than just a placebo.
This is the thin end of the wedge where they're using placebo effects in order to continuously expand their claims. And you are distracting people away from other strategies that might be effective.
But as deaths from opioid overdoses continue to rise in the U.S., more states are turning to acupuncture to treat pain and to reduce prescriptions of opiate narcotics. A handful now pay for acupuncture through their Medicaid programs. Ohio, which has some of the highest overdose death rates in the country, expanded Medicaid coverage to include acupuncture this year.
This is a leave no stone unturned conversation.
Barbara Sears is director of Ohio Medicaid.
We need to consider anything that we can that extends beyond just the opiate itself. So what other kind of treatment forms are out there?
California, Massachusetts, Oregon, New Jersey, and Rhode Island currently cover acupuncture through their Medicaid programs. And Delaware and Washington State are considering doing the same. Vermont, which has been grappling with a high number of opioid thefts, debated paying for acupuncture for its Medicaid patients. But the state decided ultimately there was not enough scientific evidence to fund the ancient practice. For the world, I'm Alan Yu.
Let's take a few minutes to touch on a few stories that are not necessarily making big headlines, like the incredible rescue of an Indonesian teenager after spending 49 days drifting at sea. My BBC colleague Celia Hatton tells us the boy was aboard a floating fishing hut where he worked.
They say it's one of the world's loneliest jobs. Aldi Novel Adelang worked by himself on a floating fish trap anchored far off the Indonesian coast. The 19-year-old's job? To burn lamps on board the simple wooden hut and then catch fish attracted to the glow. Once a week, he'd hand over the fish he'd caught and get fresh supplies of food. It was supposed to be a 6-month gig, just Aldi, his walkie-talkie, and his Bible. One night, a fierce storm snapped the ropes keeping him in place. For 49 days, Aldi drifted, staying alive by eating fish cooked with wood he'd snapped off his hut. He traveled thousands of kilometers, suicidal at times, he admitted, and he cried every day, until a Panamanian ship plucked him out of the waters near Guam in the western Pacific. Aldi's parents told reporters this was the third time he'd been set adrift, but this time he'd vowed never to set foot on a floating fish trap again.
Wow, 49 days. How can you blame him? My BBC colleague Celia Hatton there. Here's another bit of news that caught our attention today. The World Health Organization says unpaid internships will be no more. For decades, interns at the WHO have worked without pay and without travel stipends. The UN agency says it wants to make internship programs more accessible. Christabel Abewe, who's from Uganda, is a former intern, and she says she's thrilled about the policy change.
I mean, I was overjoyed. It's such great news because personally, I had a brilliant experience while I was there, and the program opened up great doors. I managed to, you know, get into a PhD program only because of my participation in this internship. So, and there's lots of other, you know, young professionals in these countries with similar capabilities and abilities as mine, and even a passion, you know, for global health. But because of lack of funding, their participation in this internship program is very limited.
Now, from paid internships to a free concert at an international airport. That's what some travelers passing through Geneva Airport in Switzerland were treated to recently, all thanks to a stranded orchestra. You see, the Camerata of Le Mans Orchestra was en route to Venice, and when their flight got delayed, they put on a free concert for fellow passengers. And as long as we're on the music tip, here's an interesting partnership. The music streaming app Spotify has teamed up with Ancestry.com. The idea here is to create playlists with your family history. Aisha Hassan is a reporter with Quartz. What is this collaboration between Spotify and Ancestry.com all about? What are they setting out to do?
So essentially, they've teamed up to create this custom playlist generator that's meant to give users a curated list of tracks that's based on the regions or the cultures that make up their heritage.
And how does it work? I mean, you upload your DNA map and out pops like, if you're from West Africa, you might like Baba Mal or something like that.
Right. So I think a misconception people have is that the Spotify account receives all your DNA results. That's not right. So basically, you go to the custom generator, and then the user will manually input the different regions that you're from. And if you've done a DNA test before, then you obviously have right in front of you, okay, I'm 20% from East Africa, maybe 30% from East Asia. And then Spotify will generate a track that represents your genetic makeup.
Well, I suppose the algorithm could make all sorts of assumptions, but to see how it works, I ran my own genetic background on the beta version online and got my playlist, which included this song called Gur by the Serbian pop rockers known as Moby Dick. And this is what they sound like. You know, this was a really nice discovery, but it doesn't really hit me in my musical sweet spot. So it can't be all fun and Serbian dance pop for everyone. How are people reacting and responding to this new collaboration?
So far, the information I have is that within the first day, 10,000 people signed up for this playlist. But as to whether people are going to continue listening to these playlists that are generated remains to be seen. Because like you said, not all these songs are going to hit the musical sweet spot.
So it gets more specific if you have an account and they've checked your DNA and where you're from. But still, I mean, doesn't this leave a lot of room for kind of offensive content?
The most backlash I've heard is people sort of worrying, what does it mean for my data? What does it mean for my privacy? But like I said, users actually have to manually put in the region. So Spotify doesn't actually get any of your DNA results.
Identity is such a complex thing. Is this going to really work for people and make us all feel like we're interconnected, you know, one great big world, or will it anger some people?
I mean, I see where you come from. I think the bottom line is that whatever it is, people seem to be curious about discovering new music, largely because there's some tie to who they are. So I think that whether or not people continue using the playlist, that remains to be seen.
Aisha, what's going on with Spotify? Because they're kind of launching out on, you know, collaborations with dating apps. They're doing this business with Ancestry.com. It's more than just a music streaming site.
I think Spotify definitely has built this foothold around trying to provide the most customized service for its users. So I think they're just trying to branch into different aspects of society and the market, trying to figure out ways to do that.
So, Aisha, what is the sound of you? Any good discoveries when you ran your own background?
So, like you, I don't have an Ancestry DNA test, and I just used the version online. And to be honest with you, I didn't know any single one of the songs that came up on my playlist.
Right, nor did I.
Yeah, nor have I listened to it yet, but I have saved it to my Spotify, and I think I probably will listen to it.
Ayesha Hassan, a reporter with Quartz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So let's leave you today with music we do know. If you are from West Africa, I would hope Spotify would offer up this classic from Senegal's Baba Maal. This is Sidiki from his 1994 album, Fire and Futa. And there's a sweet spot, and that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.